Okay, let's get started with our last class for the semester. As I said in class last time, just a reminder again, the exam will be part multiple choice, part essay, about an hour or a third of the exam allocated to multiple choice, and two-thirds or 2 hours of the exam allocated to essay. I will have you do the multiple choice on Scantron, so please come prepared, bring a pencil. Even if you're taking it on laptop, make sure you have a pencil. Okay, and again, also remember, as I said, the exam is entirely closed book, but with your exam, you will get a packet which contains all of the statutes that I think one would need or could possibly in a million years need to answer the questions on the exam. So I don't expect anyone to memorize statutory language, just have a good handle on how the statutes operate, be able to locate quickly what it is that you're looking for, and respond to the questions that way. Also, I will be in the office all day tomorrow, which is Thursday. I have a sign-up sheet if you want to sign up for office hours. Please feel free to do so. But also, by all means, if you are here and you have questions and I'm in my office, you need not make an appointment. Feel free to stop by and ask questions. If I'm in there, I'm happy to meet with you. I will give priority to students who do make an appointment, but if I'm not seeing anyone, there's no reason why I can't talk to you if you have a question. So I'll be here Thursday at least through 6 o'clock tomorrow night. Friday is still a toss-up. I don't know whether I'm gonna be here or I'm gonna be in Kentucky, but Saturday for sure, I will plan on being here between 10 and 2. I'll put up a sign-up sheet. You can sign up again or stop by. And if need be, I am willing and perfectly happy to stay here as long as people have questions and need my assistance on Saturday. But if at 2 o'clock I don't see anyone around, I'll head out for the day. So, okay. So that's where we're at in terms of exams. Anybody have any questions on logistics for the exam? No? We're good?
If we're doing it on left, are we in here or where will we be?
You know, I don't know. The exam schedule that's posted now should have rooms on it, so it should tell you, but I don't know the rooms off the top of my head. Anyone else? Okay, so I want to devote a little bit of time to finishing up our discussion of Erie Doctrine. I think that it will not take the whole time, so if you have questions, I'm also happy to stay and take questions until the end of our class tonight. But when we left off, we were talking about, remember, the Erie Doctrine all stems from this, these two, really, but one provision in particular in the U.S. Judicial Code, which says that federal courts are supposed to apply state law in diversity claims and other state law claims over which they have subject matter jurisdiction unless some federal statute or constitution directs otherwise. In Erie, the Supreme Court basically says that this means that from here on out, federal courts are supposed to apply state substantive law and federal procedural law, and state substantive law includes everything. Statutes, regulations, common law decisions of the high courts of the states, all of that is state law, and that's what the court's supposed to apply. Going forward, it turns out that it can be a little bit of a sticky business trying to sort out what is procedural law and what is substantive law. And so the court has taken a couple of different approaches to trying to figure out whether a state law is substantive or procedural for purposes of the Erie Doctrine. We saw one of those ways that the court has tried to do this is through that Byrd balancing test. The court has tried to look at what the purpose underlying the state law is. If it looks like it has a substantive purpose, err on the side of applying it. Even if it looks like it's procedural, the court then goes on and does this balancing test where it's trying to consider the state interest in uniform or consistent outcomes between cases in state and federal court against the federal interest in having a uniform system of procedure. And I said under this Byrd balancing test, the more that you can show, the more predictable and more certain it is that the failure to apply a state law in federal court will change the outcome of the case and change the outcome in one predictable way, burden one predictable party as opposed to the other. The more that you can say failing to apply this state law will always make the plaintiff lose or always make the plaintiff win, and the more certain we are that that's the result, the greater the state interest under the Byrd balancing test in having the state law applied. And conversely, the less we're sure that it will affect the outcome at all, and even if we're sure it'll affect the outcome, the less we can predict who will be burdened by it, the less the state has an interest in having that state law applied. On the federal side, we talked about we have to look at the cost, both in terms of that sort of theoretical cost to the federal courts have a particular way of resolving disputes, of getting at the truth. The adversarial process, which relies on lawyers presenting adversarial evidence and a jury to hear that evidence and resolve issues of fact. The more that you can say that applying the state procedure comes closer to impacting that core of what happens in the courtroom, the greater the federal interest in applying its own law. Likewise, you need to consider the practical cost that applying the state law has to what happens in the courtroom. The more applying the state law is going to impose a financial cost, a disruption to what the court does in the courtroom, the greater the federal interest in applying its own law. And so it balances those two things. It does a nice job at getting at what is some of the heart of the concerns animating the Erie Doctrine are. On the other hand, it's a balancing test, which always makes it fairly uncertain, unpredictable, and potentially increases the cost of litigation, which are things we're always trying to not do. Right? We don't want to have procedural litigation so tied up in procedural decisions that the parties expend a lot of money fighting about procedural things like what law applies before they even get to the answer, and a lot of time, and are unable to predict those things. So the court revisits this where we left off last time in Hannah versus Plummer. The court revisits what's going on in the Erie Doctrine. And it basically does two things. First of all, it clarifies what Erie does and how cases are decided under the Erie Doctrine by taking all of the cases that have been decided under the Erie Doctrine and sorting them into these two tracks and identifying that there's really two types of ways that an Erie issue might arise, or two types of ways that state law might conflict with federal law. The court says sometimes state law conflicts with a federal rule of civil procedure. And when it does, we really don't have an Erie problem, we have a Rules Enabling Act problem. And so the court in Hannah says, hey, look, if there is a direct conflict between a federal rule of civil procedure and some state law out there, go back to your old Rules of Decision Act. The Rules of Decision Act never said that state law applies wholesale. It always had this exception, highlighted in orange, that said the state law applies except where some federal statute provides other ways. The rules of civil procedure are all enacted pursuant to a federal statute. And so if a federal rule applies, here it is, that's an except as otherwise. That's a federal statute. And so the court says, where the state law conflicts with a federal rule of civil procedure, you apply the federal rule of civil procedure as long as it fits within the scope of authority Congress has granted the courts to draft the federal rules. And we were talking at the end of last class, that's a really broad authority. Congress has extended almost the full constitutional power to the Supreme Court to draft rules of civil procedure for the federal courts. And so as long as we can say that a rule is rationally capable of being described as procedural, rationally regulates procedure, that satisfies the Rules Enabling Act and the Constitution. And so the federal courts have to apply the rule of civil procedure and not the conflicting state law when there's that direct conflict. The court also told you, and you see it again if you read Shady Grove today, you see Justice Scalia points that out as an aside note, that the Supreme Court has never found a rule of civil procedure to be unconstitutional. They're always rationally capable of regulating procedure, and that makes sense. I mean, think about it. It would take something pretty unusual to think of a rule that ended up in the rules of civil procedure that didn't somehow rationally regulate procedure. Note, the court acknowledges, I mean, all the way back to Erie and that concurring opinion with Justice Reed, everybody acknowledges that sometimes when you regulate procedure, that will have an incidental effect on the party's underlying rights and obligations. But that's okay. That's just the way it goes, as long as it rationally regulates procedure. The other way that Erie problems arise, the court explains, that's the true Erie case. That's the case where there's some state law out there that kind of looks procedural. kind of looks like it's about what happens in the courtroom as opposed to what happens outside the courtroom before the lawsuit starts. But it has some effect, too, on what happens outside of the courtroom. There's that state law like that, and there's no rule of civil procedure that really conflicts head on. You could actually apply both the state law and the rules of federal procedure perfectly consistent with one another. Someone could follow both of them. And the true eerie question is, under what circumstances do federal courts have to apply those state laws? Those that are not in direct conflict with federal rules of civil procedure. And I had said, you know, prior to Hannah, the court had answered that with that balancing test in Byrd. And Hannah refines that a little bit. The court goes back and says, well, you know, what we have to do is we have to look at the purpose of the state laws on some level. We have to look at the purpose of the state laws in light of the purposes of the Erie Doctrine. And remember, way back, I said, at the beginning of last class, the purpose of the Erie Doctrine is to promote intra-state uniformity, to make sure that within a single state, Pennsylvania, New York, California, pick your state, cases are decided consistently between state court and federal court. That a case doesn't come out differently just because one of the parties can use diversity jurisdiction. So our whole purpose here is to promote uniformity in decisions between federal and state court. And so what we have to do when we're looking at these state laws is we have to think about those purposes and we have to ask ourselves, is this the type of state law that if we failed to apply it in federal court, a plaintiff would always choose to go to federal court to avoid the state law, or conversely, a defendant would always choose to remove to federal court to avoid the state law? This is about discouragement of foreign shopping. Will failing to apply the state law in federal court encourage foreign shopping? If so, we got to apply it because we want to discourage foreign shopping. Does it impose significant enough of a burden on the parties that somebody is going to choose a court to avoid it? The other purpose was what the court saw, the Erie court saw, as the inequitable administration of justice that arises when federal courts don't apply state laws. It's really just a very, it's about the same thing. It's just looking at it from the court's perspective instead of the litigant's perspective. Does it change the nature of the proceedings so dramatically that it's inequitable to allow someone to get around the state law by virtue of diversity jurisdiction? And it's really the same kind of inquiry. Is it that the burden imposed by the state law is so predictably significant that someone would actually choose a court to avoid that state law or to get the benefit of that state law? And so that's where the court leaves off. And so the court says, basically, hey, if you look at our decisions up until, not the most helpful slide, if you look at our... looked really helpful on my desktop, just so you know. Imagine yourself sitting at my desk. Looks great. So the court says, up until this point, right? Up until this point, all of the cases we've had decided that have involved federal rules of civil procedure have been situations where the federal rule of civil procedure and the state law at issue don't really conflict with one another. The state law adds obligations to the federal rule, but you can comply with both. And so the court talks about this Cohen case, which I told you was in that table in Spencer. Cohen is the case that involved a shareholder derivative suit. That derivative suit was brought in federal court under diversity jurisdiction. Under the New Jersey state law, anybody who was bringing a shareholder derivative suit who had a small stake, if you were a large institutional shareholder, this didn't apply to you. But if you had a small stake, I think it's less than 5% of the outstanding shares. If you were a shareholder bringing a derivative suit like this, you had to post a bond before the suit could go forward. The idea being that the corporation might incur litigation costs as a result of your lawsuit, and that if you ultimately lost, the corporation could recover its litigation costs against the bond. Okay. Federal Rule 23, now 23.1, also provides some rules for shareholder derivative suits. And so clearly, Rule 23.1 was going to apply in the federal case. The question in Cohen was whether this state law, this New Jersey state law, had to apply as well. And the way the court sees this is an eerie case because these two rules do not conflict with one another. The federal court could do exactly what I said, which is apply Rule 23.1, make the plaintiff comply with all the requirements in 23.1, and at the same time, without changing anything about Rule 23.1, could also make the plaintiff comply with the bond requirement. If you look through the text, you'll see Rule 23.1 does not say anything about whether or not the plaintiff has to post a bond requirement. It's just not there. And so the court sees this as, these aren't really two rules in conflict, this is an additional thing. As long as it's an additional thing, the state law is imposing an additional thing, then we go through this twin aim Erie test. We ask ourselves, hey, is this bond requirement the kind of requirement where we think a plaintiff would actually bring the lawsuit in federal court just to avoid the bond requirement? Yeah, it looks like it probably, I mean, given that if you're a small stakeholder, you probably maybe can't even post the bond, even if you can, better to not have to. This is exactly what Erie's about, discouraging plaintiffs from choosing federal court to avoid this state law. By the way, anybody know why New Jersey might have a law like that? Any ideas? What do you think? Well, not New Jersey in particular. I mean, I'm not, why New Jersey per se? Why would any state? Why does New Jersey hate shareholders?
Is it a way of encouraging corporations to come to their state so they have extra protections with their laws?
And how does it provide extra protection?
They know that less people are going to bring suit because more people can't post the bond.
It will discourage people from bringing shareholder suits. I think it's more pointed than even that. It means to discourage particular individuals from bringing small shareholders because of the perception that those shareholders may actually be bringing frivolous lawsuits, right? And so this is a rule about preventing strike suits against corporations to protect corporate assets. I think you're right to encourage corporations to do business in New Jersey. If you think about that, that really is a point, although it's a procedural device, the state is using that procedural device to affect some substantive obligations and rights. It's true that on some level, it really does not in any way change the corporation's duties or its directors' or officers' duties to shareholders. It doesn't. It doesn't say anything about what the duty of loyalty is at all, what the fiduciary duties are. But it has an effect on those rights and obligations by preventing small shareholders from suing to enforce those rights and obligations. And so that kind of gets at what this doctrine's about. It's about preserving state substantive choices in diversity cases and in state cases that are otherwise in federal court. And so it seems to make sense that we apply this. It seems like it would be inequitable not to. Yeah.
So is that one of the things that we've argued in the future?
Well, I want to come back to that because I think that factors into what's going on in the dispute between Ginsburg and Scalia in Shady Grove, the extent to which we really do rely on things like that. But so as the court reads this, this is the kind of requirement that would really encourage someone to file a diversity action in federal court as opposed to state court, and that's why we should apply this. Contrast that with what the court sees in the actual Hanna case, and that is the court says, now we have a federal rule and a state rule that really are in direct conflict. There is no way that one can comply with the federal rule and comply with the state rule. To impose the state obligation on the plaintiff means that the plaintiff can't meet the bare federal obligation. The court says, look, here, 4F at the time, 4D at the time, now 4E, says you can serve an individual in a whole host of ways. You can serve them pursuant to state law. So it would have been okay to follow the Massachusetts statute. That would have been fine, but it doesn't require that. It also says that you can serve an individual like the defendant in Hannah by serving summons on the person individually or doing exactly what the plaintiff did in this case, which is leaving service of summons with an adult at the plaintiff's home. The Massachusetts statute requires a very particular form of service and puts a very small time limit. You have to serve the defendant personally. It's not good enough to leave it at the home. It has to be personal service, and you have to do it within a year of opening the estate. There is no way that these two rules can coexist. Either you can serve at the home, and that's okay under the federal rule, or you can't under the state rule. That, for the court, is different than Cohen. And once you get to this situation, where invariably you cannot apply both rules, the court says the federal rule wins. Wins with the caveat that it has to be within the Rules Enabling Act, has to be rationally capable of being described as procedural, but that's all the time. The federal court applies the federal rule of civil procedure, and so in this case, the court applies Rule 4, and the plaintiff gets to go forward with her lawsuit. And it doesn't even matter what you think about this. You can argue till the cows come home about the fact that you think that this is going to encourage forum shopping. Too bad. You still apply the federal rule. Okay. So now I want to talk about the Shady Grove case, which is the most recent Supreme Court decision, but it really comes, it's nice if you have the time to sit down and read Gasparini and Shady Grove back to back, because if you read both of these decisions back to back, you will see that in Gasparini, Justice Ginsburg authors the majority opinion for the court and Justice Scalia dissents, and then in Shady Grove, the opposite happens, and in both opinions, they both say exactly the same thing. Just one time Ginsburg gets the votes and one time Scalia wins. So you've got a couple things going on. You've got federal rule of civil procedure, which provides the circumstances under which a federal court can certify a class action. We'll talk briefly about this next term, but really it's probably beyond the scope of a first-year class. But just to give you a little indicator, if a plaintiff wants to go forward with a class action, no matter who she is, what she's doing, she has to show four things. She always, in the federal courts, has to show numerosity. That there are so many people that would be within her class that they couldn't all individually participate in a lawsuit. Two, she has to show that there are actually common questions of fact and law amongst all the class members' claims. Three, she has to show that her claims are typical of those of the class members. It makes sense for her to be the person that goes forward because she looks like just like all the other people. And she has to show that she and her lawyer will adequately represent the class, because ultimately this class is going to be bound by whatever she does. So no matter what, anybody wants to go forward as a class action, in federal court, you've got to establish those four things. And then the second thing you have to do is have to show that you have a class claim. The rule sets forward three types of class claims. You have to show that if you were to go forward individually, either there's a limited fund available, and so your lawsuit would prejudice other people's ability to get money. Or you have to show that you are looking for some kind of relief, that if somebody else went forward in their lawsuit and got different relief, the defendant would not be able to comply with both orders. There'd be a risk of inconsistent judgments. And that's a civil rights class action, is a good example. An employment discrimination case where the plaintiff is seeking some kind of injunctive, systemic relief, that would be a class action for that reason. If a bunch of different employees sue separately, we'll get all kinds of different injunctions. Or you have to show that you've got a lot of people with the exact same claims, and their claims are so similar, the common issues predominate over them, and a class action is really the superior way to sue. And these are usually cases where plaintiffs have suffered identical harms in consumer transactions, but small harms. So that nobody has a sufficient incentive to sue individually, but everybody collectively, if they get together, have kind of a big harm. that's probably like everybody in this room has probably been a member of one of these types of class actions at some point in their life. This is when your credit card company or your bank company charges you an undisclosed fee, but it's a small fee. You become a member of a class action that way, something like that. Okay, so that's Federal Rule 23. Well, New York, in its infinite wisdom, passed an amendment back in the 90s to its civil code. And one of the things this amendment said is this language at the bottom. You can go forward to civil action, blah, 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 blah. Here's what you need to do. But by the way, if you are suing to recover a statutory penalty, you cannot go forward as a class action in New York. No matter what. And so the plaintiff in Shady Grove is doing just that, is suing to recover this statutory interest penalty. He has a small claim of about $500, but all told, the plaintiff thinks there's enough people in New York who are entitled to this same statutory penalty that the defendant probably really owes more than $5 million. And so the plaintiff brings a lawsuit in federal court in diversity as a class action against the defendant. And the question for the court then is whether or not this provision, this New York provision, ought to apply. This provision about whether the plaintiff can actually do this as a class action because it's a statutory penalty. So I want to come back to this discussion that Mr. Cox asked me about the purposes behind this. Does anybody have any idea why New York might have enacted this prohibition on statutory penalty class actions? Think about the dynamics in this lawsuit. I mean, what I just said, the plaintiff here has a claim for about $500. And so if the plaintiff has to go forward individually and really wants to collect its $500, it has to pay the litigation costs that it, you know, that entails to get $500. You're all, maybe a lot of you are thinking about becoming lawyers at some point. How many of you here would represent your client if the maximum your client recovery was $500? I am glad you all shake your head no, because if you say yes, you're probably going to starve in your first year of practice. You can't recover your expenses out of $500. And so even if the plaintiff wants to do this, is mean, nasty, vindictive, and irrational, which sometimes clients are, no lawyer is going to take this because you can't, you'll go broke, right? On the other hand, if they can do this as a class action, if you could do this as the lawyer for the class, the potential recovery is $5 million. Now how many may will take the case? At least it's viable. I mean, you can pay your expenses out of a third of $5 million, right? So this, why is it you think that New York might have passed this law? Yeah.
I think it's for the same reason that Shadi said, is that to entice businesses and corporations who might have to pay penalty interest to come and set up shop there and be operating so that they can be covered under this particular law.
Yeah, and I think that's right.
It's an incentive.
It's an incentive. Unpack it just a little bit more about what might be going on here. Yeah.
Try to rein in some of the outlandish big rewards that class actions are sometimes awarded. They're trying to kind of bound them a little bit.
And why might you want to bound them? I think ultimately to entice corporations to do business, how might binding or putting some limit on potential class liability do that? I mean, I think about one of the, so yes, it could limit future suits. Of course, this always bothers me when people say that, because at the end of the day, Allstate did not pay, I mean, it screwed a lot of people out of $500, which is kind of a raw deal for all these people who didn't get their $500, right? So unpack a little bit more what the real concern is. Is it really just New York wants to say, open season, anybody wants to defraud consumers, feel free and come here because we just really want corporate business? I don't think it's that.
Maybe they're trying to comply with a previous Supreme Court decision that they said that you can't just give out anything for like a punitive type damage. Is it? No,
I don't really think it's that because this isn't punitive damage. Those decisions wouldn't apply here at all. This isn't punitive damages. This is bound to. It's an interest rate per month you didn't pay.
Just trying to limit the actual damages?
Yeah, although I still don't think,
I forgot the question.
I just want to be, I guess I just want people, we all throw out, here's the thing that everybody throws out this, it's to help corporations. I want us to be more thoughtful about what that really means, right? What is it that New York's really trying to discourage and encourage here? Or how is it that this helps corporations? And how does this discourage, I think that's right, how does this discourage frivolous lawsuits?
You have to show that you have actual damages.
Even if you have actual damages, you can't bring this as a class. Right? You're screwed. If your actual damages are not enough to merit litigation, you can't collect. So why? I don't know. I mean, what is this really getting at?
To limit the amount of litigation that would be frivolous, would it have anything to do with just judicial economy then in the state of New York? It would be a busy legal docket.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that encourage more cases though? If they couldn't bring it as a class, everybody would have to file individually. Mm-hmm. If they had, I mean, it would be almost the opposite. Like, we don't have enough cases, let's bring some more for our judges.
Yeah, and so this is the thing, right? The only reason this works is because they know that won't happen, right? They know that individual litigants will not file these cases because of what we said. No lawyer will bring a claim for $500. Maybe an individual litigant will do it pro se, but even then, I mean, at a certain point, people are irrational. They're not going to waste every moment of their day trying to recover their $500. It's a difficult thing. It assumes, in part, that some of these claims, some class action lawsuits, really are frivolous. Now, it costs lawyers money. They've got to front the costs to bring the class action lawsuit. And, you know, ultimately, just saying, whoopah, class action, you don't win. But it's still a lawsuit. You still have to prove your claim, and you have to actually win. The defendant can still file a motion to dismiss. The defendant can still file a motion for summary judgment. The defendant still gets to go to trial and defend against the claim. The problem is twofold, right? All of those things cost money. The defendant has to pay a lawyer money to file a motion to dismiss, to file a motion for summary judgment, to try a case, to file a post-judgment motion. Also, the defendant isn't guaranteed at any point that the defendant really will win. And in part, the fear is that if the plaintiff's lawyer is able to pool enough of these claims together to get to $5 million, $10 million, $2.5 billion as potential damages, regardless of what the merits of the claim really are, at some point, I mean, think about it yourself. If the potential recovery is $2.5 billion, even if there's only a 1% chance that the plaintiff will ever win, if you're being rational, it's not worth rolling the dice if you can settle the case for less than that. So the court's concern here is with the way in which class actions give the plaintiff unequal leverage in negotiations, put settlement pressure on a defendant to settle a claim, even a claim that it knows is not meritorious, to avoid the cost. By the way, you should also know the class action certification process is an expensive process. It costs the defendant and the plaintiff a lot of money to go through the certification process. So to avoid the cost of litigation, and also because of the potential risk, because the risk of recovery, even if it's a small risk, is big. Right? So the idea behind this is prevent the plaintiff from putting that kind of settlement pressure on a defendant to settle a claim. I say all this because to what extent should that matter? Mr. Cox's question, should that matter in the Erie analysis? This is part of what's going on between Scalia and Ginsburg and one of the things that they're fighting about. Go back to my example from Cohen. I said that the Supreme Court says, hey, this is an easy case because these two rules can operate side by side. The federal rule says nothing about a bond requirement. New Jersey's just adding something on. If you actually were to pull up the text of the New Jersey statute and the federal statute, you might make a pretty good argument that the court's wrong, that that's a little bit of a revisionist history. Because if you pull up these two statutes side by side, you will see that they do a lot of the same thing. Federal Rule 23.1 says what the shareholder has to do, that the shareholder has to be a shareholder at the time of the transaction. It can't be a strike suit. You can't go out and buy shares afterwards to complain about a transaction that you think might have been bad. But you have to be an adequate representative. The New Jersey rule does a lot of that too, and just adds a bond requirement on top of it. So if you were to look at the entirety of these two rules, it seems like they're really doing the same thing. New Jersey just added more. And so when you say that they're really kind of different and you can do this, you're kind of playing fast and loose with what these rules really do. Well, why is it that the Supreme Court in Cohen might have done that, disregarded the clear language of these two statutes, which look like they're doing about the same thing? For Justice Ginsburg, it's what I said, that New Jersey likely had some somewhat substantive reasons for passing this procedural statute. New Jersey was interested in limiting what it perceived to be this problem at frivolous shareholder suits and protecting corporate assets to encourage corporate investment or whatever host of other reasons it had. And so you might say that when a state statute, when we can think of some potentially substantive reasons why a state would enact an otherwise procedural statute, one of the things we should do is we should try to read the federal rule as narrowly as we possibly can to allow these two rules to coexist. Think about it this way. This Federal Rule 23.1, there's two ways to read this. It is silent as to a bond requirement, but it says you have to do a whole host of other things. You might say the fact that it lists the things you need to do and that doesn't include a bond means you don't need to post a bond. That would be a plausible interpretation. You could also interpret it to say the fact that it lists a bunch of things and doesn't say anything about a bond means it doesn't say anything about a bond. So we can say you have to do these things and you have to post a bond. When you have two competing interpretations like that, per Ginsburg, she says, hey, pick the narrow one to protect the state's substantive interest so you can put both statutes together. In fact, that's what she would do with respect to these two federal rules in Shady Grove. She's like, you could read Rule 23 and then just add this other thing. You got to be an adequate representative. It's got to be the right type of class action. And the substantive law you sue under has to allow you to proceed as a class action, and here it doesn't. Two can exist side by side, no trouble, and then we protect what we think is really New York's quasi-substantive interest in discouraging frivolous lawsuits. Probably doesn't surprise you to note that Justice Scalia is not willing to do that. He says you can't. This is silly. How do you even know what New York's purpose is, right? You're just guessing. You're reading Cuomo's signing statement, and from there you're extrapolating this huge purpose on the part of all the legislators who enacted that. No, we can't do that, right? We just have to look at the language. Are they doing the same thing? If so, they're in conflict and the federal rule applies. So, stage one, we have two competing theories of how you read a federal rule. Some justices and some courts taking Ginsburg's lead, who says, when it comes to this first step in our Hanna analysis, when we're just trying to figure out whether we have a conflict between a federal rule and a state law, or we can apply them side by side, we need to consider the state's purposes in enacting its law. If the state has some substantive goals in enacting the law, we should take as narrow a reading of the federal rule as we possibly can to avoid a conflict. Two, okay, if we can apply them side by side, what do we do? We talked about these twin aims of discouraging forum shopping and avoiding inequitable administration of justice. is that a place where we can introduce the state's purpose back in again? If the state has a substantive purpose here, maybe that makes it a stronger argument that people really will forum shop around this rule. Again, it won't surprise you to learn Scalia doesn't want to look at that at all, just wants to look at, would a rational person really go to federal court to avoid this rule? Finally, Ginsburg wants to introduce that balancing back in. Even if we think that applying this or not applying this state law will encourage forum shopping, is there some countervailing federal interest that suggests we should apply federal law? And Scalia doesn't want to talk about that at all. We're not going to talk about interests behind the federal rule or the statute or the state law at all. We're just going to look at whether they're in conflict, and if they're not in conflict, whether we think the difference is significant enough to encourage forum shopping. I mean, I think that the practical answer is, going forward, you've got to be able to do both of those things and make both of those arguments. I think you still want to be flexible enough in your statutory interpretation to be able to argue that a federal rule and a state rule can apply side by side. And you still want to be flexible enough in your argumentation to be able to argue about whether or not there is a federal interest in applying the federal rule beyond, whether this is essential or core to a uniform system of procedure. Questions? Okay. I'll leave it at that. I really will. If people have questions beyond Erie, I really will take questions. Anyone? Calls, questions, going once, going twice.